Welcome to the Sec Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdraver. On today's show, air traffic control. A couple weeks back, the White House announced its support for modernizing the way we route planes. The United States has one of the most complicated airspaces, if not the most complicated airspace in the world. And many are saying that the way we handle it is outdated, that it's more like World War II than the 21st century. And how can we bring air traffic control into the 21st century? And what are some of the concerns from opponents who want to keep this under the government? Joining me to discuss this is Mark Scribner, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and Baruch Feigenbaum, assistant director of transportation policy at the Reason Foundation. Gentlemen, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having us.
So the basic technological point here is that some are saying the technology is outdated and that the Federal Aviation Administration has not been able to update its technology. What exactly do they mean when they say that the technology we use to route traffic is outdated?
Well, a couple different things. So first of all, we're using a system that was really World War II era technology before a lot of the modern features that we have today. If you're looking at how some of the communications happen, they actually use paper strips, not computers, when they go around at various boats, the FCC, because that's basically all their computer system allows them to do. Most other countries have a more modern system that was developed in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And one of the problems is that the FAA, by nature, is a very conservative organization. They're focused on safety, and they should be. But in order to get new modern developments, you really need an organization that's actually looking to the future and willing to experiment with technology.
When you say paper strips, what do you mean?
Well, some of the communication that goes on, they don't actually have electronic reams of doing it. They actually have paper strips, and in some cases, they actually have to read back instructions. They can't get it on a computer. So when the pilots are in the airplane, they have to read back instructions as opposed to getting it on a computer. And anytime you're repeating things and communicating, there's an opportunity for errors there.
And is it fair to say just in general that radar is outdated? I mean, so currently the system is using radar, which people know from way back. And is that just not up to snuff for 2017?
Well, radar is inherently less precise than what you'd get if you were using, say, a GPS technology. So one key element of modernization is the transition to space-based ADS-B, which would allow satellite surveillance much more precision, which means you don't need to space aircraft as far apart. So even in congested airspace, such as the United States Northeast region, that means that you're going to be able to track a lot more aircraft in the air safely and have them move safely closer together, which can cut down on delays, since those are the areas, congested airspace are the areas where delays pose the biggest problems.
And that could theoretically do a lot of things also. It could mean quicker flights. It could mean fewer delays. Could it also mean fewer carbon emissions if you're environmentally conscious and the fact that you have planes flying so far apart just because radar, correct me if I'm wrong, can only pinpoint within 1,000 feet, whereas a properly implemented GPS system could mean 10 feet?
Well, right. And I think that's one thing is how we do routing in controlled airspace for commercial airlines today. Generally, they have to fly in these flight plans that are based on paths that were set up when they built these beacons on the ground, where then basically that serves as a waypoint for the aircraft to fly over, and then it makes a turn toward another beacon. That is the World War II era system. I mean, if you go back even before that, they used to light bonfires on tops of hills to sort of guide aircraft from the ground. But that's when you go toward a space-based ADS-B system, that means you can directly route these flights. So that means shorter flights. And yes, if you're concerned about the environment, That means reduced emissions, reduced fuel consumption. I mean, that's also a major business case for the airlines, being able to reduce their fuel consumption, which is a major cost in air travel, and one that in the past has been very unpredictable for them.
Right. And just to define our acronyms here, ADS-B is Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. Who the hell comes up with these acronyms? Because I cannot imagine someone who's not a transportation nerd who reads that and understands what the hell that is. But for the listener's benefit, we're talking about GPS technology. So we've talked about basically how we move from, or the goal is to move from an old technology to a new technology. And, we're going to just call this next generation air transportation system. Now the FAA was supposed to do this, right? So it's not like the FAA has just sat in a room and said, we oppose new technology. We're Luddites. I mean, they were supposed to do this, right? Isn't this the law?
Well, I don't think it's entirely fair to blame the FAA. And I think for the reasons Baruch laid out that, yeah, there's a major problem with having a safety regulator operate a 24/7 high-tech business, which is what air traffic control is. But, you know, the FAA is subject to annual appropriations, and this is an area where Congress has screwed up a lot in the past. So even though, yes, the FAA has seen, they have major procurement problems. We've seen projects, components of NextGen go wildly over budget and delayed. But Congress has also not provided consistent funding that's necessary to undertake a very complex modernization project, which is what NextGen is. And you know, thanks to sequestration, we saw the FAA Academy, which trains all in Oklahoma City, which trains all the controllers. We saw that shuttered. We saw contract towers threatened. So you know, a lot of the people who've, you know, ironically been claiming that the reform proposals threaten rural access and things like that. In fact, it's the status quo that threatens rural access and sort of just general continuity of the system. So I think that it's important to keep in mind that we're not just talking about technological modernization, but the whole process. Annual appropriations, and then having a safety regulator try to operate this business, I think the whole management process is flawed.
Is it accurate, Baruch, to say that this is a privatization? Mark kind of just pointed out that it's not entirely the FAA's fault, and maybe if Congress had done a couple things differently, the FAA could have pulled this off. But now we're talking about just kind of giving up on the FAA and saying, we're not going to leave this to you anymore. We tried this, it didn't work. Is privatization the right word, or what exactly are we talking about here?
Yeah, so privatization is actually the wrong word, I would say. And a lot of opponents of this process are calling it privatization, trying to scare off parties that might be interested. We call it corporatization because what it is it's spinning off the air traffic control functions into a new nonprofit. Now, the FAA is still going to have a role. The FAA is still going to be the safety regulator. So it's not like we're totally cutting the FAA out of the process entirely. We're just spinning off the air traffic control functions, much as most every other developed country in Europe and Canada have done. And it's going to be self-supporting from user fees. But because it's a board that is the board that oversees it is made up of members, what we would call a stakeholder board or a task holder board, it's considered a nonprofit, not actually a for-profit entity. And that's a big difference. We actually looked at some for-profit conceivable entities, and we really didn't see a major advantage to them over a nonprofit.
Right. And I think, you know, the only partially privatized, to use the P word correctly, the instance of an air traffic control provider that we have is the UK NATS. And it's still majority held by the UK government, but it does operate as a for-profit company. It does issue equity shares. And I think a fundamental problem that, you know, Baruch sort of hinted at and what his colleagues at Reason Foundation looked at was when you start going down the for-profit route, you're basically guaranteeing the politically anyway, willing into existence a rate regulator. And that is something we don't want. That's something we'd rather have the board, now subject to constraints, the board will be able to raise fees to lower fees, but the fees have to be based on the cost-based principles from the International Civil Aviation Organization. So there's not a, you don't have a a way for the board to impose fees that bear no resemblance to the costs of the service that's being provided. So I think that this is a at least on rates, what we have is sort of a self-regulating entity, which this is what Canada has done. There is a disapproval process and there is an appeals process, but ultimately these decisions are being made by the board of directors of this nonprofit corporation.
So currently you've got the FAA dealing with this, and they are funded by the General Treasury, which means that tax dollars that just people pay through a variety of means go to fund this process. Now, this would be different. This would be fees. And the new entity would be a board of, or governed by a board of directors. This includes representatives from airlines, unions, airports, and others. I guess there's some opposition here from Democrats who see a potential for price gouging, for people raising fees to increase airline profits, taking the government out of the equation where safety is obviously their number one concern. We're now going to have some parties arguing about what the fees should be. How does this not become a chaotic function? I mean, I can assume that unions and airlines don't see eye to eye on everything, and that unions and airports don't see eye to eye on everything. And while the multi-stakeholder model has been successful in many areas, especially in tech policy, when we're dealing with safety and we're dealing with air traffic control and it's complicated, how do we ensure that this new entity doesn't become chaotic or prone to regulatory capture?
Well, I think that part of it is the structure of the board, but also and the composition of the board members. But also there's the fact that this is conveniently ignored by opponents of reform. It's that the board members are not there to put forth the interests of the parties they nominally represent. Now, they would be forbidden from working for any of the entities that they are there representing as a stakeholder, but they would have a legal fiduciary duty to the corporation, not to the entities that they're there sitting on the board for, but to the corporation. So, you know, that is one safeguard that I think is critically important. This was included in the reform legislation from Chairman Bill Schuster last year. We expect in the coming weeks, when the new proposal is released, that'll be there as well. And we also expect that some of the concerns over board composition and those sorts of matters will be addressed in this forthcoming bill.
So that's one argument that you've addressed, that it won't necessarily lead to higher costs and allow private businesses to reap the profits. Democrats have also argued that this could lead to underserved areas not getting their much needed improvements. Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the House for the Democrats, has said this is, quote, a Trojan horse for undermining workers' wages and handing massive tax breaks to billionaires and corporations. Is there a concern here that the worker protections that labor unions have fought for that exist in our current regulated market, that this is just a union-busting Trojan horse? Do you have anything to say to that, Baruch?
That is a rather silly argument, because the Air Traffic Controllers Union, which is the union representing the folks that perform air traffic control duties, has fully supported this proposal. They've supported it last year, and there's a number of reasons why they support it. First, there is no reason to believe that anything will change vis-a-vis the union. It won't be per se strictly a government union, you know, a union more in the nonprofit sector, but there's nothing that indicates wages or benefits will necessarily go down. The air traffic controllers, what they've experienced over the last few years are the effects of not having certainty in the budget process. Are we going to have a government shutdown and they're not going to get paid? Are we going to have all kinds of disturbances? Are we going to decide that we're going to balance the budget on the backs of the air traffic controllers and do something with the funds?
So that's an advantage to having fees, is that it's separate from that discussion. It's not an appropriations issue anymore. It's not a political debate about how much money the FAA should get. It's just fees that go specifically to this purpose.
There were two elements that got the NATCA, the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, to support the reform efforts. The first was existing pensions and the like won't be touched, and then during transition, the existing collective bargaining agreements that these workers have won't be touched for a period, and then they'll be subsequent renegotiations.
Kind of like a grandfather mechanism to make sure current people don't get screwed.
But exactly. But the other one was exactly what you said, is that having a user fee system not subject to annual appropriations would provide the consistent revenue streams that they need for the stability to continue operating this. Like I said earlier, if you're shutting, we have a third of our certified controller workforce right now in the United States that is retirement eligible. That is a major problem. And when Congress is messing things up, is messing the consistent funding up, and we're seeing the controllers training academy shut down, which means you can't get more controllers into the pipeline, that's a huge problem. So the status quo from a workforce perspective is really failing these FAA employees. And I think it's a bit disingenuous it's a bit amusing for Democrats to claim this is union busting, because you had a handful of conservative opponents last year claiming that this was a union giveaway. So it's either a really, really pro-labor or really, really anti-labor if you listen to the opponents.
If you want to get into the parties that are really opposed to this for maybe a legitimate reason, you're looking at what we would call the business jet folks. And these tend to be very wealthy individuals, millionaires that fly on more or less private planes. And because of the way fees are calculated right now, they don't pay the percentage of airspace that they use. They don't pay a respective number. So because there's fewer folks on these planes and because of some other carve outs, they pay much less than your average Joe who's on a commercial airline stuck in the middle seat with 2 inches of leg room in front of them. And that's
you just described my weekend.
That's right. Most folks. And so that's really not a fair and equitable system based on the amount of airspace that you use. So because they would pay more, they have some interesting front groups that are basically saying, oh, this is terrible, trying to, what I would say, throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
So you've actually got the Republicans proposing something that would lead to the rich paying more, and some Democrats opposing the reform, but obviously they're not saying that they oppose it for that reason. And when you talk about the trade group that represents that, correct me if I'm wrong, this is the National Business Aviation Association.
Correct.
That's the big boys with the big jets. All right. So getting to some of the other opposition, Congressman Peter DeFazio, and he's the ranking member. So if Representative Schuster is the chairman of the Transportation Committee, this is the ranking member because Republicans are in the majority. He's saying that you know, yes, you've made some arguments against the other opposition, but what about this one? That we're setting this corporation up as a too big to fail entity, because yes, we're relying on user fees. And yes, you're saying that it's somehow going to be a nonprofit that breaks even and everything's wonderful and we don't need to dip into the general treasury. But what happens if this entity is mismanaged? And what happens if it's too big to fail? How do we head off this possibility that taxpayers are going to be asked to bail out this new entity that's unproven? And yes, you've seen it in other countries, but these countries don't have the same complex airspace that we do. Like Canada is obviously a simpler situation than the United States. I mean, so is there anything in the recommended proposal that would prevent too big to fail from becoming a problem?
Well, explicitly in the proposal from last year, it said that no debt assumed by the corporation shall be guaranteed by the federal government. You have a number of now, basically, when
you can say that, but what happens when safety is it needs to, like, we need safety, right? So you can say,
you need operations. Now, it is true that UK Nats following 9/11 did receive government assistance, as did the aviation industry in much of the world, because it took over 5 years for volumes to return to pre 9/11 levels.
And that's a catastrophic event,
right? But you know, really, what I think DeFazio misses, and it's actually kind of funny because his latest counterproposal, and he's been sort of all over the map on this, on trying to, I think it's purely political why he's trying to stop reform efforts coming out of the Chairman Schuster. But his latest proposal would basically convert all FAA spending into mandatory spending and create, you know, basically what he wants to do is, he's saying the FAA isn't broken. He's saying, in this case, he's saying that we can continue doing things. We can continue doing next gen as we have been doing. But things apparently are broken enough that he's calling for exempting the FAA from all sorts of the congressional oversight that in the past he's expressed concern concern about, basically exempting the FAA from broad procurement requirements, from appropriations and tax rider oversight, basically consolidating power conveniently into his committee, and that is what we've seen. So it's sort of, we've seen really silly proposals. We've seen a lot of hypotheticals about things that really didn't, you know, in NAV Canada, which is what the model, the reform proposal is based upon, they never bailed, the Canadian government never bailed out NAV Canada following that. And we think if a well-structured nonprofit, the board will be able to raise emergency fees when necessary. And it's also important to keep in mind that we're not talking about simply raising money and then funding it by this nonprofit. They're going to issue revenue bonds. So this is going to be financing. So when you're then talking about the biggest risk then for a bailout would be somehow they get things turned so horribly wrong that they're not able to service the debt. And I think that is a much lower risk than sort of what DeFazio is making it out to be.
I also want to take on this NAV Canada thing and the fact that we are apparently not at all like Canada. We're just so different here, even though we have the longest continuous border in the world. So it's true that Canada has a lot less population, but they actually have quite a few overflights, because if you look at the ways that U.S. planes are going to Asia especially, and even going to Europe, you've got a lot of U.S. planes flying over Canadian airspace. So the fact that they are able to integrate their local traffic and those overflights indicates to me that it's a very good model and shows why you can't just look at the population of the two different countries and say, oh, wow, this is drastically different.
I mean, we have Dunkin' Donuts. They have Tim Hortons. I mean, their football league is a little weird. Three downs instead of four downs. I mean, I'm not sure, Baruch. I just think that we are just fundamentally a different culture. But let's turn over to politics for a second, because obviously you guys make a nice case substantively, but of course we have to deal with politics. You can't just make a nice argument and expect things to happen. So we've got the administration supporting it. We've got Secretary of Transportation Elaine Chao supporting it. And some of the groups that you guys have mentioned, we've also mentioned others, Democrats opposing it, some of the private jet folks and Delta Airlines, which we didn't get to, but we can maybe close out the show.
Delta Airlines actually has switched to a more neutral position,
right.
So they are no longer opposing it. I think that's important.
I would say there are a number of Democrats that do support this proposal, particularly experts in aviation and folks who have served in the Obama administration, Clinton administration, and worked on these issues. Unfortunately, they tend not to serve in Congress, so it's it's important to keep in mind where the opposition is, that this really ought not be a partisan issue. And among the aviation community, it isn't at all. Really, what you're seeing is congressional leadership in the Democratic Party that has decided that they are going to reflexively oppose this.
How do we get over the hump? So you've got the president supporting it, but that's not, this is a legislative thing. So we've got this bill, the AIRR, AIR, hilariously named. I've joked on this podcast about how these names are so ridiculous. But the Aviation Innovation Reform and Reauthorization Act. Where is this going? Is this something that's actually going to pass this year? Or is this going to have to be something that is not done in a discrete legislative proposal? It will have to be done as part of a larger FAA funding situation. I mean, there's a lot there, but if you want to talk through the politics.
Well, I think how it's at least initially proposed, and Baruch, you can talk more about the politics of this, but I think it's going to be, this is what Chairman Schuster is going to introduce in the coming weeks is not going to be a standalone air traffic control reform bill. It's going to be the broader multi-year FAA reauthorization. So I don't see this moving through Congress without it being attached to a comprehensive reauthorization, in part because I think that there are Democrats in Congress who quietly are interested in this and I think willing to support this. Their leadership, unfortunately, isn't. But there may be a way to sway some Democrats over to the correct side, and that is through other titles of the FAA reauthorization bill. So they may be more interested in airport financing or funding may be really interesting.
Yeah, I think there's some concern about underserved areas that Pelosi brought up. Maybe there's some room for compromise there. Baruch, do you see it similar, that it's going to happen in a big package, not as a standalone bill?
Yeah, I think if it happens, it's going to be in a big package. And the advantage there is you're going to have something for the different groups that don't see much in air traffic control reform. So we talked about some of the subsidies that we might not like that go to the airline, the small airports. We talked about the for the airports themselves, an increase probably in passenger facility charges because they need that in order to maintain the airports. I also think there's got to be some strategic thinking on the Republican side on how to get Democrats. And so maybe that means it, this is not necessarily a administration priority full blast, because obviously President Trump is not so popular among Democrats.
And yeah, so what makes you think that?
There's kind of got to be a balancing to how does this actually get passed and how do we build a coalition?
Is anything going to happen on the administrative side? Of course, with Republicans' control of the White House, they are able to make appointments and put people in charge of independent regulators. But because this involves actually the FAA giving something away by law, is there anything that can be done on the administrative side, assuming Congress doesn't act?
No, this requires a very heavy lift from Congress. I'm the current FAA authorization, or rather the current extension to the FAA law expires September 30th. So, and I think there's a decent chance, I think a very good chance, that we're going to see it extended at least once more before we can actually get a reform proposal through.
All right, well, you've both written some great stuff on this topic, and we'll make sure to link to that in the show notes, but we'll leave it there. My guests have been Mark Scribner, Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and Baruch Feigenbaum, Assistant Director of Transportation Policy at the Reason Foundation. Gentlemen, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Next time you're on a flight that is delayed due to an outdated air traffic control system, listen to this podcast or send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. If you're really delayed because of this system that needs an overhaul, write a review in the iTunes store. There is no better way to help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.